Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum. Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to LA does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. I'd like to welcome you once again to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here in the first show of the month of December. And we're going to do a little sharing tonight. In recent weeks, I've been asked, what does an uneducated parent do to facilitate the education of their children so that they succeed and do better than the parent has done with the lack of education? So we're going to dedicate tonight to sharing some basic information. Not So Mad Science being a dedicated scientific research program where the sciences are made simple, and that any parent can teach and have something to offer, elevate their child beyond them in their educational pursuit. How do we do that? What can I, as a parent who does not understand biology, chemistry, physics, or some of the other sciences, do to help my child? There is that one thing that we all wake up to every day. Our own body, human body, has the same basic design. Two eyes, two ears, a nose, a mouth, a chest, an abdomen or stomach area, two arms, two legs. But even with that, there are some incredible variations in body shapes and sizes. All of our bodies are miracles of engineering by that great one who caused this all to come into being. He sophisticatedly fashioned the most incredible computer to ever exist, the human mind. No electronic computer can compete with the capacity of the mind to calculate and process information simultaneously or individually. Nor can any computer compete with the creative capacity of the human mind to expand itself beyond its base or root program. The body grows and develops. It feeds and maintains itself It is the only machine of its type that is self-replicating and self-healing. It senses the world around it and deals with these countless challenges of life, the human body. So the first question the parent must ask themselves, what makes a body? Many scientists say that there are hundreds of possible ways to approach that question, a body. The ignorance of science these days that says biologically humans are relative of other mammals. And the human body that we know today was made by millions of years of evolution. For those who are the Darwinist, the science of anatomy shows that the body is made of many parts called organs composed of millions of cells. And the science of genetics tells us how, in a sense, the body makes itself from an instructional code hidden in that genetic blueprint. Functionally understand what makes the body a body, we can do a comparative study and compare it with other similar bodies in the world around it. There are many parallels between our bodies and those of other mammals, the other 4,000 other mammal species that they believe to have been able to find and categorize. We have warm blood, hair, skin, and a bony skeleton. Also, like other mammals, we feed our babies on mother's milk. We belong to the group of mammals called, and I believe personally, misquoted as being primates. Primates, with regards to animal life, includes lemurs, monkeys, and apes. And indeed, the orangutan, gorilla, those, that family of great apes, chimpanzees, do resemble the human being in some details. Our genetic material made up of DNA is over 98% identical to a chimpanzee's. To which the question must be asked, why? There are some who say the human being is an evolved primate up from the chimpanzee. However, science today, over these last 10 years or so, let's say 20 years, has found that not to be the case. We are not evolved chimpanzees, thus the chimpanzee must be a devolved human being. Something to think about. So we must begin as a parent to wonder, what are the human origins? The Greek philosopher Aristotle taught that in order to understand something thoroughly, we should know its origins. A concept that he himself partook from the Egyptian mystery system. Know thyself. So to understand what makes a body, we must look at the body's origins. Some people believe that human beings are a specially created creation of that supreme being, that deity. Modern biological science, in its limited understanding, sees the human body, like all natural living things, as the result of evolution. But that would be incorrect. It holds that the human body was developed over millions of years through a long sequence of changes that have made it better adapted to its environment. But why, if, and in fact, the structure of the human being can be sourced back not thousands of years, not just millions of years, but multiple millions of years back to a period of time? Thus, the great apes cannot trace that existence back in that same parallel of time. Therefore, the idea that primates and human beings run a similar course cannot be said. What does that leave us? In 1859, the English naturalist Charles Darwin, with his limited understanding, announced his theory of evolution in great detail in his book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. And I must apologize for that ringing in the background, dear friend. You know, some people do forget that this is not So Mad Science and not the social hour. But we will continue. And there we go again. In Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, his book caused a great deal of controversy in its time. Fossils of human bones and teeth show how the human species may, in his limited grasp, have evolved over several million years. An early human predecessor was the small-brained, chimp-like creature known as Australopithecus, or southern ape, which walked upright 3 million years ago in an area called part of Africa. Almost 2 million years ago came the bigger brain tool-using Homo habilis, or handy human. Then about 1 million years ago came the larger, more skilled tool maker, Homo erectus. But this concept, this idea, and this theory of evolution has since been dismantled and proven to not be so. So where does that leave us? We're still looking for the human origins, for the remains of upright walking. Modern human beings were found to be older than 50 million years. So who was this ape-like creature or the southern ape that was found? and in fact, did the carbon dating of their bones truly say that they were 3 million years old or less than 6,000 years old? These things must be looked at. These things must be reevaluated and recalculated with more modern equipment to be more right and exact. Early anatomy, people have been fascinated by the body's inner structure for thousands of years. So-called cave art from what is determined prehistoric times shows that the artist knew about the inside of the body. In ancient civilizations in Egypt, Greece, China, India, and elsewhere, people studied and wrote about the twin sciences of anatomy, the body structure, and physiology, how the body works. They did this partly from curiosity, but also to understand how the body became ill. The early advances of prehistoric type of sciences of the Greek and Roman era. Those scientists, including what is said to be the father of modern day medicine, Hippocrates, which we found to be untrue, of the ancient Greece, were thought to be the first doctor. It has since found and been told and proven that modern medicine, in comparison to the ancient Greeks, existed in Egypt and in the Arabian Peninsula, as well as in China and parts of the Nipponese island chain. In AD 129 through circa 201, Galen, thought to be the first person to write in great depth about anatomy, was from ancient Rome. Although he was a doctor, tradition prevented him from dissecting or cutting open dead people. So many of his descriptions are adapted from animal studies. So great was Galen's authority amongst the ignorant that people blindly accepted all of his teachings, including the mistaken ones, for over 1,000 years in Europe. In Europe from about 1300, during the 1300s, there was a new interest in the arts and sciences during this period of the Renaissance, the French word for rebirth, this Renaissance period. People began to study the body more thoroughly. We have now reached that point in our program, dear friends, where we must take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Yeah. forget about it.
Welcome back. Let's get right back into it. It was during the French Renaissance, or rather I should say during the Renaissance period, that French word that means rebirth, that European people began to study the body more thoroughly. They dissected human corpses to see exactly what the body was made of. The major anatomical book of this period was the De Humani Corporis Fabrica, French meaning the fabric of the human body, which was put together by Andreas Vasilius. He was a professor of anatomy at Padua, Italy. Vasilius drew and described what he actually saw rather than what tradition taught should be present. His work brought the science of anatomy into the European modern world. We got to be clear on this particular section because you can't study science without studying history, because things have been taught a particular way. The Chinese knew these things well before the European advance. They had been practicing acupuncture and a variety of chiropractic medicine and specialized holistic medicine for millennia before the European advent. In the Arabian Peninsula, the Egyptians and others were practicing and doing surgery long time, thousands of years, while the European was still in their dark ages. Okay? So this modern science of anatomy brought the European world into a new explosion of science. It was by the 1600s that the idea of microanatomy began to have its birth in Europe. 1600, the body's basic anatomy was understood in detail. But the invention of the microscope opened up a new world to see and study. Microscope pioneers such as the Dutchman Antonie van der Leeuwenhoek and the Italian Marcello Maffei studied human organs under the microscope and saw that, like other living things, the body is constructed of cells, the building blocks of life. Individual cell is a living entity. It uses nutrients and energy and carries out chemical processes, controlled in its own cellular content, and reproduces itself. Each cell also has a special role to play in keeping the body running smoothly. Over the last century, we have gained more knowledge and a greater understanding, a far greater humanistic view of what makes a body. A new type of microscope called an electron microscope can magnify an object a million times or more. It has revealed the structure from which cells are made, even their very molecules. One of these molecules is called the deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, the blueprint from which life evolves. In 1953, an English scientist named Francis Crick and an American biologist named James Watson unraveled the structure of DNA. Inside each cell, long strings of DNA actions in a chemical code from growth of an embryo to an adult human. And for running and repairing that machine called the human body. Each instruction is in the form of a gene in a single cell, and there are perhaps more than 100,000 genes on DNA totaling almost 10 feet, 3 inches in length, give or take. When an egg cell is fertilized by a sperm, and before I go into any further, we got to understand the egg in a woman is the material by which the body is formed. That's what mommy carries. The body is formed from that material. But the mind of that growing body, that fetus that is going to develop, comes from the sperm father, because sperm is the root material of which brain forms, because sperm thinks. Sperm knows where to go. Sperm travels. It's moving. It goes to war with other sperm in the darkness of the womb to be the one that will fertilize that egg. What grows first? The brain. And it is from that brain that signals are then sent out via those DNA strands to form other parts of the body. But it's not until the mind is housed in brain to tell the body what to do. Father, don't waste your sperm unnecessarily. Because you're the root cause and seed by which mind comes into play. Let's continue. Egg cell is fertilized by a sperm. A new baby is conceived. the egg cell and the cell sperm cell pass on in the form of genes the instructions that determine the general shape and size of the new person and what features he or she will have. So let's take a look at some of these parts and pieces. You're a parent. You're looking to share with your young child basic information that you yourself may not have learned, but you want them to have a grounding of understanding of these things so that when they're in school, they can grasp and grow to those places where you did not. The body. There are more than 5 billion human beings on the earth. Each is a unique individual. And each of these unique individuals all have bodies that have the same basic outer design. And inside, they all have the same structural parts in the same places. Some work better than others. And we say basic because we know from anatomy and the genetic sciences that all life evolved from the black germ of life and devolved down to that germ of life that has no material to self-replicate itself. So the dominant gene, the black germ, and the weaker germ. Where it can be said, and this is not racial information, but it is basic human anatomy. The black germ of life only can come from black people. That weaker germ. That cannot self-replicate itself to produce certain things is housed in the Caucasian people. Dominant and recessive genes. Dominant genes in black people, recessive genes in white people. Brown man, yellow man in between. This is the genetic ladder by which the gene travels. Not up from the weaker germ, the recessive genes, but down from the dominant gene, down. The systems of the body can be thought of as a collection of systems. Each system has one major role, but is also a duplicitous role in some of the body redundancies. Redundancy meaning it is a backup system to another system that has failed temporarily. That's why it can be said each system has one major role and several minor roles. Organs. An organ is a distinct body part that carries out one or more main functions. Several organs working together make up a body system. For example, the liver is an organ that is part of the digestive system, but is also a duplicate or redundant system as an emergency backup to other parts of the body. Tissue. Each organ is composed of one or more kinds of tissue. A tissue is a group of similar cells that carry out a specialized job. The liver, for example, again, is mostly made up of sheets of hepatocytes, which is a cell that produces or processes nutrients. Cells. The cell is the basic unit or the building block of all living things, plant or animal. Cell is 1/900 in width and is shaped like a box with rounded corners. Organelles. The cell contains structures called organelles. Important example of an organelle in a cell is a body that is shaped like a sausage. It's called the mitochondrion. Inside it, energy is released from nutrients and made available for the cell to use to do its job. The next step would be molecules. Each organelle contains thousands or millions of molecules. This molecule is glucose, the body's main energy-rich ingredient. The gray balls in a molecule, cellular molecule for the body, is a glucose molecule. Glucose molecules are carbon atoms. An atom. A molecule is a combination of particles known as atoms. A glucose molecule has 24 atoms, including 6 carbon atoms. All life is based on organic molecules or carbon-containing molecules. So let's bring all this together into a synopsis. From body to atom. All matter in the universe, the body is made of tiny particles called atoms. Collections of atoms make up molecules. Molecules make up organelles. Organelles make up cells, and so on. In a level-by-level hierarchy or organization in the body, when early anatomists, those who study anatomy, studied the whole body, they were interested mainly in the large structural parts, the organs. Later studies allowed the body to be viewed and understood on a different level of its hierarchy. Its microstructural parts, the cells. Other scientists developed a greater understanding of the body's functions and what it does. These scientists were particularly interested in the nature of the body system and tissues. It is only in the latter half of this century, with the development of electron microscopes, that we now have been able to view the smallest, most basic units in the body, organelles and molecules. So let's take a quick run down the lane of the body's chemical contents. And this is just from observation. You're a parent. You don't have no great education, but you can look in the mirror and study yourself and what you do. You hear terms and words, but you then can begin to make associations of terms and words to what you see in the mirror. substances that make up the human body can be divided into different groups, which are similar to the groups of substances called nutrients, those things that we take in to survive. The nutrients we are use are found in the food that we eat. The primary nutrients or the main nutrients in the body are called carbohydrates, proteins, lipids. And again, this is not so mad science, so we're going to take words that you aren't familiar with and give you a common understanding so you know what it is. Lipid. Oh, what the hell is that? Lipids are fats and oils. So the body's main nutrients are carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, and minerals. If these main nutrients and other less important substances could be taken from the body and transformed into familiar forms, they might look like something like a collection of ingredients. Those ingredients would be proteins. Okay. Proteins would be cheese, fish, chicken, red meat. Carbohydrates would be rice, flour, bread, sugar. Minerals would be those things that are specialized, such as water, iron, as in for your fingernails, sulfur, that you might find in the tip of a matchstick. Yes, that's in your body. You need this mineral. And other such trace elements like zinc, which you might find in a tin can. Copper, which you see in the water pipes. These are minerals that are essential to the body's function. Lipids, those fatty oils, make up the thin microscopic sheets known as membranes that form the outer skin of each cell and most of the organelles. They are similar to the fats and oils that you use to cook with and in butter. So let's look at body shapes and sizes. Again, now you're a parent. And you're looking to help educate a child when you have less education than what that child has. But you know how to look in a mirror. And you can study yourself. Yes. Human bodies come in all shapes, sizes, and proportions. The kind of figure you have depends in part on whether you are a child or an adult, a female or a male. Now, let's be clear. There is no androgynous structure in between male and female, except for that natural thing called a hermaphrodite, where the body got caught between within the womb of its mother, between cutting itself into either male or female. There's no such thing as being stuck mentally one and physically the other, or physically the other and mentally something else. Once the transition is made to determine which you are either male, female, or the true hermaphrodite. Okay, so the figure is mostly the result of the size and shape of your bones of your skeleton. Total body height is only about 1 inch more than the skeleton's height. So if you're 5'9", your skeleton is 5'8". in an adult, a quarter of his height is taken up by one bone in each thigh. The femur. M-U-R. The femur. Body proportions also depend mainly on bone size. You've heard of people say, well, I'm this way because I'm big boned. No, that just means you got a lot of mass. That don't necessarily mean you're fat. For example, some people have broad shoulders. Others have narrow ones. Some people have a short torso, or I mean the trunk, the abdominal area. And they have long limbs. Others have a long torso and short limbs. Diet, exercise, and living conditions also affect your shape and size. Excess food is stored as fat that pads other areas out in the body. While regular exercise can lead to large bulging muscles. So your natural structure varies depending on what you eat, what you do, where you are, and how you live. Body measurements. Far back in history, people did not have rulers or tape measures. But they did have body parts, such as hands and arms, which they could use for measuring. The size of the body parts varied from one person to another, but they were an accurate enough guide for a building method or the building method of that day. The ancient Egyptians, those in India, all had measuring systems that were based on parts of the body, although they were often used by different names for the same measurement. The names they used are as follows. The width of your finger. The Egyptians called it zebo. The Greeks called it a, and in India they called it an angula. The width of the palm. The Greeks called it a shep. The Greeks called it a palist. But there was no corresponding term for that amongst the Indians. Not the Indians of North and South America, but the Indian of the Indus Valley area in India, that area where Pakistan and places are. The width of the spread out of your fingers from tip of pinky to tip of thumb to the top of the index finger. The Egyptians called it, in a word that we're very familiar with, a span. The Greeks called it a stithemi. And those of India called it a pradesa. Pradesa. Amongst the Egyptians, fingertip to the point of the elbow was called the royal cubit. The Greeks called it the Olympic cubit. And amongst those in India, they called it the vitasi. Now, we need to be clear about this Greek-Roman connection here. It is based upon the work of that noted historian, George G.M. James, in his great work called Stolen Legacy, Greek philosophy is stolen Egyptian philosophy. It is in that great found that the sciences of the Greeks and Romans is actually stolen Egyptian philosophy or science. Tip to tip of the outstretched arms. There's no equivalent measurement for the Egyptians. It wasn't used. But amongst the Greeks, it was called the orgula. The India, it was called the vayastama. These were common body measurements that were used throughout history until the advent of the nominal or standard ruler. Some metric, some inch. But there were two rules that were used to standardize measurements. The meter, the yard, and the square. But what role did food play with respect to the shape of the body? Well, you cannot consider food without also considering the condition on which food is used. The body's genes play a large part in controlling how it grows and develops. But the amount and quality of food that a person, babies and children who do not get proper nourishment, grow more slowly than they would if they had a healthy diet. As adults, they may not be as tall or as well developed as they would have been if they had been well nourished. Unhealthy living conditions with a lack of light and fresh air can also have an effect on growth. It has been proven that poor living conditions and unnutritious food is in short supply amongst the poor during the 19th century when soup kitchens were in huge swing. The height of people tended to be lower than what is considered to be normal. Thus, it is in that great work by that great wise man, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that he wrote the book that he was given the wisdom to write. He wrote How to Eat to Live, thus allowing that computer, that biological computer, that self-replicating machine to reach its full potential. Because you eat right, live right, think right, do right, thus you grow right. But you can conduct an experiment of a sort on yourself and with others with regard to your body proportions. Even if you are the same height as a friend, you may have longer legs or shorter arms. Variations like these depend mainly on the size of the bones in your skeleton. Using a poster board, disc, you can make a human graph to show how body proportions vary. Measure the distance, between different discs with a ruler. And you can ask your friend to stand up straight with his or her shoulders square press the hand, the bony points on the shoulders, the elbow, wrist, hip, knee, and ankle. Stick a different colored disc on each of these parts. Stick disc on a whole line of friends and measure the distance between the disc on each person. How much of the body height is made up of legs? Is the upper arm longer than the lower arm? Do tall people necessarily have longer arms than shorter people? It varies greatly regardless of height and shape. Thus, as parents, you need not be a biologist to explain to your child how the body works. You can get in the mirror, look at yourself, understand yourself, and teach your child to be the scientist that they are. That way they get past that point of clumsiness in their education where they don't understand and do as they're told. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back. Let's see what we can do here to our listening audience such that you find what we have to say to be both pleasing, beneficial, as well as thought-provoking.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. If we just let it be, na 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 na, the world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl, just you and me. Wake up, all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long. Before their judgment day, so won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up, all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out. They do it every time. The world won't get no better. would just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.
Welcome back, welcome back. Now, I was texted a question with respect to cellular mitosis. So for the more advanced among us, I'm going to offer this explanation on cellular mitosis. Okay, I think we've got what we needed here.
Hey, check this out. Cool, huh? I bet you wish you could do this. Have a clone, clean up around the apartment for you, go to class, maybe take your mom out to dinner on her birthday. Well, you can't do that. And actually, there are some really good reasons why you can't do that. We're going to talk about those in the next episode. But you know what can clone themselves? Your cells, like almost every single one of them. And in fact, they're doing it right now. For any creature bigger than a single-celled organism, all of life stems from cells' ability to reproduce themselves, because that's what allows organisms to develop and grow and heal and keep from dying for as long as possible. This particular kind of cell division is called mitosis, and it's responsible for a whole lot of your body's key functions. If you get a cut, your body needs to make new cells, mitosis. Have too much to drink, damage your liver, you gotta replace those cells, mitosis. Tumor growing in your spine? Fortunately, again, mitosis. While you go from a 7-pound baby to a 70-pound child, it's not your cells that are increasing in mass. You're just getting more of them over and over and over again. That's mitosis. This process is so central to your life that it will take place in your body over your lifetime about 10 quadrillion times. That's 10,000 billion times. Like all split-ups, it's not easy. Gonna maybe be a little bit messy. There's a lot of drama, and it can take a surprisingly long amount of time, but trust me, after we're done with it, we'll all be better off. So you are made of trillions of cells, just like giraffes and redwood trees. And remember that inside each cell, there's a nucleus that stores your DNA, which contains all of the instructions on how to build you. That DNA is organized into chromosomes, and as we've mentioned before, in your body cells or somatic cells, you have 46 chromosomes grouped into 23 pairs. One of each pair is from your mom, and the other one's from your dad. Cells with all 46 chromosomes are called diploid cells because they have two sets each, and that's what we're focusing on today. You also have haploid cells that have half as many chromosomes as 23. And those are your sex cells. They're produced in an equally fantastic process called meiosis, which we'll be talking about in the next episode. But for now, the main thing to remember about mitosis is that it allows one cell with 46 chromosomes to split into two cells that are genetically identical, each with 46 chromosomes, all in order to keep the party of life going. Now, the nucleus in your cell controls everything that goes on in the cell. It has all the instructions necessary for making the cell survive, so you don't need to duplicate the whole cell. All you need to do is duplicate the DNA, get it wrapped up, and then if you have two separate pockets of DNA, that's all you need to have two new cells. Mitosis takes place in a series of discrete stages called prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. You can just say that over and over again and let it sink into your head. And part of what's, you know, really amazing about this whole process is that while we know what these stages are, we don't always know the underlying mechanisms that make all of them happen. And this is part of science, Science isn't like all the stuff we know. It's how we're trying to figure all this stuff out. Consider job security. If you ever want to be a biologist, there is a lot of stuff that future biologists have to still figure out. And this is one of them. All right, let's get our clone on. So most of their lives, cells hang out in this limbo period called interphase, which means they're in between episodes of mitosis, mostly growing and working and doing all the stuff that makes them useful to us. During interphase, the long strings of DNA are loosely coiled and messy, like that dust bunny of dog fur and laundry lint under your bed. That mess of DNA is called chromatin. But as the mitosis process begins to gear up, lots of things start happening in the cell to get ready for the big division. One of the more important things that happens is that this little set of protein cylinders next to the nucleus called the centrosome duplicates itself. We're going to have to move a lot of stuff around in the nucleus, and that's going to be regulated by these centrosomes. The other thing that happens is that all of the DNA begins to replicate itself too, giving the cell two copies of every strand of DNA. To brush up on how DNA replicates itself like this, check out this episode and then come on back. Now the cell enters the first phase, or the prophase, when that mess of chromatin condenses and coils up on itself to produce thick strands of DNA wrapped around proteins. Those, my friends, are your chromosomes. Instead of dust bunnies, the DNA is starting to look a little bit more like dreadlocks. And the duplicates that have been made don't just float around freely. They stay attached to the original. And together, they look like little X's. These are called the chromatids, and one copy is the left leg and arm of the X, and the other copy is the right leg and arm. Where they meet in the middle is called the centromere. Just so you know, these X's are also called chromosomes. Sometimes double chromosomes or double-stranded chromosomes. And when the chromatids separate, they're considered individual chromosomes, too. Now, while the chromosomes are forming, the nuclear envelope gets out of the way by, like, completely disintegrating. And the centrosomes then peel away from the nucleus, start heading to the opposite ends of the cell. As they go, they leave behind a wide trail of protein ropes called microtubules running from one centrosome to the other. You might recall from our anatomy of the animal cell, the microtubules help provide a kind of structure to the cell. This is exactly what they're doing here. Now we reach the metaphase, which literally means after phase, and it's the longest phase of mitosis that can take up to 20 minutes. During the metaphase, the chromosomes attach to those ropey microtubules right in the middle at their centromeres. The chromosomes then begin to be moved around, and this seems to be being done by molecules called motor proteins. And while we don't know too much about how these motors work, we do know, for instance, that there are two of them on each side of the centromere. These are called centromere-associated protein E. So these motor proteins attached to the microtubule ropes basically serve to spool up the tubule slack. At the same time, another protein called dynein is pulling up the slack from other ends of the ropes near the cell membrane. After being pulled in this direction and that, the chromosomes line up right down the middle of the cell. And that brings us to the latest installment of Biolography.
So how do chromosomes line up like that? We know that there are motor proteins involved, but, like, how? What are they doing? Well, remember when I said earlier that there were a lot of things that we don't totally understand about mitosis? It's sort of weird that we don't, because we can literally watch mitosis happening under microscopes. But chromosome alignment is a good example of a small detail that has only very recently been figured out. And it was a revelation like 130 years in the making. Mitosis was first observed by a German biologist by the name of Walther Fleming, who in 1878 was studying the tissue of salamander gills and fins when he saw cells' nuclei split in two and migrate away from each other to form two new cells. He called this process mitosis, after the Greek word for thread because of the messy jumble of chromatin, a term he also coined that he saw in the nuclei. But Fleming didn't pick up on the implications of this discovery for genetics, which was still a young discipline. And over the next century, generations of scientists started piecing together the mitosis puzzle by determining the role of microtubules, say, or identifying motor proteins. Now, the most recent contribution to this research was made by a postdoctoral student named Tomomi Kiyomitsu at MIT. He watched the same process that Fleming watched and figured out how at least one of the motor proteins helps snap the chromosomes into line. He was studying a motor protein called dynein, which sits on the inside of the membrane. Think of the microtubules as tug-of-war ropes, with the chromosomes as the flag in the middle. What Kiyomitsu discovered was that the dynein plays tug-of-war with itself. Dynein grabs onto one end of the microtubules and pulls the tubules and chromosomes toward one end of the cell. When the ends of the microtubules come too close to the cell membrane, they release a chemical signal that pumps the dynein to the other side of the cell. There, it grabs onto the other end of the microtubules and starts pulling until, smack, it gets punted back again. All of this ensures that the chromosomes will line up exactly in the middle, so that they will be split evenly. That discovery was published in February of 2012, a couple of weeks before I sat down in this chair, and 134 years after mitosis was first observed. If you want to join the ranks of scientists who are answering the many questions left about mitosis and lots of other things about our lives, maybe someday I'll do a biography about you. Now, so far we've gone through the interphase, where the centrosomes and DNA replicate themselves and get ready for the split, the prophase, where the chromosomes form and the centrosomes start to spread apart, and the metaphase, where the chromosomes align in the middle of the cell. And now it's time to separate the chromosomes from their copies. This time, motor proteins start pulling so hard on the ropes that the X-shaped chromosomes split back into their individual single chromosomes. Once they're detached from each other, they're dragged toward either end of the cell. Since the prefix ana means back, that may help you remember the name of this phase called anaphase. After this, it's just a matter of using all that genetic material to rebuild so that the copied genetic material has all of the accoutrements of home. In the last phase, telophase, each of the new cell structures are reconstructed. First, the nuclear membrane reforms, the nucleoli form within them, and the chromosomes relax back into chromatin. And a little crease forms between the two new cells, which marks the beginning of the final split. That division between the two new cells is called cleavage, and all that's left is to make a clean break. This is done by cytokinesis, literally cell movement, by which the two new nuclei move apart from each other and the cells separate. We now have two new cells, each with a full set of 46 chromosomes. These clones are called the daughter cells of the original cell, and like identical twins, they are genetic copies of each other, and also of their parents. But of course, that's obviously not the case for you, even if you are an identical twin. Shout out identical twins! See me in the comments. While you kind of are a clone of your sibling, you are not a clone of your parents. Instead, half your DNA in each of your cells is from your mom and half is from your dad. To understand why that is, we have to understand how eggs and sperm are formed, and that is meiosis. And that's what we're going to be talking about next week on Crash Course. Until then, you can just watch this video over and over again, or you can just watch the bits that you want to rewatch using our table of contents, which is also available in the description for people who are using iPhones and can't click annotations. If you have any questions, you can reach us on Facebook or on Twitter, or of course, in the comments below.
Now, for those who are a little bit more advanced and wanting a detailed conversation with respect to mitosis, there you have it. Again, now, let's get back to our process here. You're a parent. You're not that educated, but you want to prepare your child for... You want to prepare your child for biology. You want to give them a leg up. You want to get them going. You want to be able to help them with their work. You're looking in the mirror. What do you see? What is the first thing that you see when you look in the mirror? Many would say, well, I see my face. Would they be right? No. Some would say, I see my eyes. Would they be right? No, again. Some would say, I see my hair. Would they be right? The first thing you see is the largest organ on the human body. That largest organ on the human body is the human skin, the body's surface. So let's get a grip. Your skin is an organ, too. When you look at the human body, nearly everything you see on the surface is dead. Your hair and nails are composed of cells that died weeks ago. Yet just beneath this outer layer, millions of cells are multiplying via this process we learned to be mitosis, making skin one of the body's busiest places. Throughout your life, your skin continues to renew and repair itself. That delicate inner parts of your body from wear and tear, from excess heat, cold, from water, and germs. It gives you your sense of touch, your skin, a living barrier. A layer of skin, usually less than 1/4 of an inch or 5 millimeters thick, is the only barrier between the body's interior with its delicate cells and finely balanced fluids and the harsh changing conditions of the outside world. Yet we rarely give our skin a second thought unless it becomes bruised, cut, or otherwise damaged. We don't take care of our skin. Few of the great scientists of the Renaissance period, that early European period when they thought they knew everything and dictated the world, such scientists as Leonardo da Vinci and Andreas Vesalius, took an interest in the workings of the skin. They thought of it as an uninteresting covering that had to be removed in order to study the much more fascinating parts that lay beneath the skin. Their ignorance was soon to be found out. Perhaps this is not surprising since there were no microscopes at the time, but a microscope is not necessary to study the skin. To the naked eye, the skin and the parts that grow from it, hairs and nails, may not necessarily look particularly complex or interesting. However, it is with the invention of the microscope in the early 1700s that the skin meant for the first time that scientists were going to look at it more thoroughly, or the European scientists were going to look at it more thoroughly. For the first time, they could see the cells that make up the skin. From this point on, people could see how intricate the skin is and what a vital role it plays. That they could see the epidermis, the outer layer of the skin, continually how it renews itself with new cells. And how tiny sensors in the dermis, the inner layer, give the body its sense of touch. That they began to look with their naked eye to see the skin for what it is, an organ unto itself. Skin is the body's heaviest organ. The skin of an average adult weighs around 9 to 15 pounds or 4 to 7 kilograms. About 1/12 of the entire weight of the body. If you wore an overcoat that heavy, you would soon appreciate how heavy your skin is. Your wraparound coat of skin protects your body from water and from general wear and tear. Like a showerproof raincoat, skin keeps out most of the water and other fluids to which it is exposed to, although it is not fully waterproof. Water is repelled by the natural oils and waxes made in the tiny subcutaneous or sebaceous glands just under the surface of the skin. These sebaceous products also keep the skin flexible and supple, which means it moves easy. Insulate the body too. When early anatomists cut open the skin, they found a soft yellowish layer beneath it. This layer, called subcutaneous fat, subcutaneous meaning under skin, This subcutaneous layer is called fat. It works like the padding in a quilt that the body warm and also absorbs knocks and bumps. Shock. Keratin. One reason that the skin is so tough is that skin cells contain a robust body protein called keratin. Sometimes keratin is flexible, for example. In epidermal skin cells, but elsewhere it can be much thicker, stiffer, and harder. For example, in fingernails and toenails. Keratin is also the material which makes up human fur, what we call hair. Like the cells at the skin surface, those in hair and nails are also dead. The only living parts of hair and nails are the growing points in their roots. Any sensations around the hair roots or in the skin and under the nails. Skin. The germ barrier. The world is full of microscopic germs. They float in the air, lie around on things we touch. Objects that are apparently clean have germs on them or in them. Your skin prevents germs from entering the body. Under a microscope, the skin surface shows many dead, flattened cells that interlock and overlap tightly, like the tiles on a roof. Few germs can penetrate this barrier, which completely covers you and completely covers your healthy skin. However, they can enter the body through cuts or breaks in the skin. The natural waxes and oils on the skin surface contain germ-killing chemicals. These are the body's own disinfectants, giving added protection against bacteria, yeast, and other potentially harmful microscopic organisms. But how sensitive we are. Before the invention of the microscope, one of the great puzzles for scientists was what role the skin plays in the sense of touch. The microscope showed that in the dermis, there are millions of tiny sensors of several different types. The sensors respond to fresh, heated or cooled, and they send tiny electrical signals along the nerves to the brain, where the signals are processed. This gives you your sense of touch. Most of the types of microscopic sensors in the skin are named in honor of the person who first described it or studied. These are mainly the Italian and German microscopic, or microscopists, as they were called in the 19th century. Pacini endings are an example. Shaped like tiny onions, these sensors are at most about 1/24 or 1 millimeter wide, and are named after Filippo Pacini, a professor of anatomy in Pisa in Italy. They respond to heavy pressure when the skin is squeezed. Messenger endings are named after the German anatomist Georges Messenger. Today, scientists know that the skin is a multi-sensitive organ. That is, it can detect light touch, heavy pressure, vibrations, heat, cold, and pain. But they are still not exactly sure how the skin does this. Early in this century, researchers tried to show that each element of this multiple sense was detected by one kind of microscopic sensor. However, they were not able to prove this. More recently, scientists have suggested that many sensors in the skin respond to more than one type of stimulation, but also that each sensor is particularly sensitive to one or more types of touch. From the billions of nerve signals common to every second, coming in at every second, from the millions of sensors in the skin, the brain assembles an overall picture of the type of touch being experienced. Some of your skin is your own private and personal air conditioner, cooling skin. Skin has other functions too. For example, when the sun shines on it, it produces vitamin D. This vitamin is used by the whole body, particularly the bones. Lots of sunlight stimulates the skin to make more of its dark pigment called melanin. And while we're on the subject of melanin, those of us who have determined that are melanated or black, brown-skinned people, possess that dominant gene. So when we're exposed to sunlight, that when it is exposed, its color gradually becomes darker. Skin also has a vital role in keeping the temperature of the body stable. If the body becomes too hot, a watery fluid called sweat oozes or secretes from tiny coiled tubes called sweat glands onto the surface of the body, where it evaporates. This evaporation draws heat from the body, and so you feel cooler. And we're not as thick-skinned as you think. Some creatures, such as a rhinoceros, their skin may be more than 1 inch thick in some places. And that rhino horn that so many people like to kill rhino for and harvest their horns for whatever silly reason, for an aphrodisiac or medicine that some people think. Their horn is nothing but matted, compacted hair. So if you want a rhino horn, let your hair get natty and matted and packed. Don't comb that puppy. You'll develop your own rhinoceros horn. Because it's nothing but hair matted together. So if the outside layer of our skin is dead, how do we lose it? Did you know that most of the dust in almost any and every room